I'll sail down the street in my new fancy car. I will rise through the buildings to the sky like a star. There's a house in Eden, even though I've lost my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay.
Listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. If you're interested in listening at home on your PC, iPhone, or BlackBerry, where this station streams live on the internet, please visit www.wsps.sps.edu or visit my website at radioghost.com for the link. I was walking alongside the mountain river down through the darkness. The sky was an ice-colored ruffled block, no moon or stars, just a gloomy, hanging fluorescence. A cold, smudging sort of evening that makes you feel like your eyes aren't open. It was late October, 2 days before Halloween, and it was cold. I was a little underdressed in my black suit, but I was moving swiftly and keeping warm. I wear an old miner's headlamp when I walk at night. It burns a roughly fragrant oil that sets out an orange, gentle light. As the oil burns, this kind of sooty rope of smoke swirls around me with an agreeable scent of train tracks. It's a bit as though there's a pleasing little locomotive puffing around my forehead, sending down this rich smoke. It's 2 miles or so in total to the Macaw Meadows, down the mountain, past the old abandoned house, and thence along the bridle path to the open farmlands. There is one dismal spot. Oh, not dismal, just troubled. After the path finally crosses the river at the shoals, and one begins to decline toward the meadow, one comes upon an old wreck of a fallen-down house. You might not even see it as you pass, so wild is the growth of young trees and bushes surrounding it. But here, 100 years ago, the forebears of my closest neighbour, Seamus Dunn, lived. They made boots for the army and shoes for the local gentry, and in a general custom, in costumes. Seamus's mother passed away young, but his father continued on in the house until 15 or 20 years ago. I met him once, a wild old man with white hair and a long white beard, much like my own countenance nowadays, I should imagine. After his father died, Seamus tried to get rid of the house, to no avail. I went, quite by accident, to a rather private estate sale. I was out on the paths, as I often am. Seamus was packing up the sellable items to be hoisted down to a local auction house. He let me browse among the things as he went in and out of the house. There was a pile of vintage clothing and some good but ancient tools. It's where I found the miner's headlamp. And, as I'm thinking of it, I believe I got my black suit there, and the shoes too. Part of my elderly manoeuvring includes checking certain key things in advance of their use. Thus, the principal purpose of my evening walk tonight was a little due diligence on my parade outfit, as I called it, the terrible black wool jacket and matching pants and pair of black shoes, which once belonged to Seamus Dunn's father. When I finally exited the forest and began across the fields, it was nearing midnight. The rigid, ice-colored clouds had broken, and the moon paddled light over the mountains. I reached out my hands to brush the cold, dead, yellowy shafts of the straw in the meadowland. Much of the field had been threshed, and there were great wheels of hay toppled about. When I reached the rock wall, I turned to head back home. I was relieved to see the mild, lumpen shapes of the storage boxes set out against the meadow. The volunteers would be here tomorrow to assemble the fairgrounds. And then, in 2 days' time, on Halloween, the town of Lemmon would gather here to celebrate its annual Demon of Lemmon Festival. There are tents and games and assorted spooky things, terrifying noises, dunking booths, gaming parlors, and every kind of sweet and meaty snack. At any rate, my parade outfit was hanging in there, the festival preparations were underway, and so I turned on my heels, ready to head home, when I heard and felt the softest, most troubling ripping tear, as of a thick wet book being sundered quietly in the soil beneath my feet. I cranked the miner's lamp to full and gazed down to discover that my left shoe had figured in a massive blowout. I took a gentle, hopeless step to test if the carnage might somehow undestruct itself. But the upper then severed free, and the clunky leather sole tumbled into the weeds, and looked, at that moment, like the most perfect little picture of a murdered footstep. I listened for quite some time to the cricket worry and my own. The leather collar of my old left shoe was hung round my ankle like a lampshade, my socky foot directly on the wet yellow grasses of the field. What is it, I wondered, that a person does in the cold night time when one shoe goes bad in the middle of nowhere? It's something along the lines of a flat tire. I should say here that I suffer from hypnopompic episodes. I'm an inveterate sleepwalker, and one of the things I was doing now in the field was attempting to verify my current state. Was I awake or asleep? For the curious experience of the sleepwalker is that they are semi-conscious, partly awake and partly asleep. Because of this, they are subject to both auditory and visual hallucination. Sleepwalkers may even wonder, as I was, whether or not they are sleepwalking. They may even dismiss the idea while great vast illusions swirl all around them. I returned my attention to the worry tending my broken shoe. At such moments of anxiety, I tend to check my pockets. And here would be another clue as to my state. If I was sleepwalking now, I might expect to find a cobbler's tool in my pocket, or even a spare shoe. Yet there was nothing in my pockets but a terribly old piece of hard candy stuck down in the bunching vertex of my pants pocket. I pried it out and then accidentally drew my sticky fingers along the jacket, leaving a smear of candy. I sighed at my recklessness. So it was that my shoe, my jacket, my pants, my entire parade outfit had all been vexed in a quick minute, attacked on the one hand by candy and on the one foot by time. I removed the sad leather cowl of the left shoe and then took off the right. Shoes in hand, I was about to depart when across the distance, Seamus and Maggie Dunn's white farmhouse caught my eye. Like his father and grandfather before him, Seamus was a cobbler. In addition, they ran an informal laundry service from their home. I could leave my things at the drop-off station on their porch, and they would certainly have me back in business in time for the Demon of Lemon Festival. I crept along the porch, dropped my pants casually to the floor, removed my jacket, and hung my suit on the iron hooks, and then carefully laid the wreckage of my shoes in the box at the bottom. I suppose I must have some tendency not to see the far side of certain of my efficient solutions, as it hadn't occurred to me, but that, of course, this one resolution created a fresh different problem, for I would now be walking home like this, barefoot, and in the yellow antiquities of my undershirt and undershorts.
As I'm walking, I know I'm not breathing. I'm not breathing. Only air. 'Cause it's filled with words once spoken by people. Hear all the whispers that have lived a thousand years. It just took me being open for them to read. Now they've reached my
eager ear.
I slipped down the farmhouse stairs. I could go back the way I came, but that would entail a very public walk across the Macaw Meadows. It was late, but an occasional car could still quite reasonably rumble past on the meadow road. Quicker and safer to continue up the ridge and then over the crest to rejoin the bridal path on the far side. The trail up was steep, and my feet were numb with the cold. Here and there a heavy log had been battered into the dirt to serve as a kind of step. Huffing and growing colder by the minute, I began to skirt across the flat rocks of the high cliff. My hands were surprisingly warm, gripping around the bold black socks. As the wind blew across the escarpment, I stretched the thin socks over my arms, like impromptu sleeves, like these kinds of mittens for awful people. I stood for a moment, looking out from the bald ridge, down toward the Macaw Meadows. Strangely, I saw now that some of the tents had somehow been set up in the interim of the last few minutes. I hadn't heard anything, nor could I see any of the workmen. In addition, the shadowy team of draft horses now stood midfield. They chuffed darkly near their stalls, quietly shrugging at the cold. On Halloween night, they'd be suited up with a train of wagons. As many as 50 adults and children would then go bumping around the circumference, maybe a mile distance in all, on the hayride. But most of the festival goers, me included, just wait and watch, looking up toward the spot where I was now standing on the bald ridge. For when the hayride draws finally alongside the meadow's near edge below, the driver will halt the horses, and the riders will shift their gaze toward the bald ridge. Seamus Dunn, leaning from his porch, will hammer the bell on his railing, and all of us, in helpless unison, will stare upwards to this bald ridge where, once upon a time, the demon of Lemon made his first and last appearance. A glowing, awful, shouting ghost of some indescribable sort. Even for the old skeptics like me, there's something about the ritual that makes it seem, each year, a little more possible that the apparition will appear to raise his spooky arms and perhaps shout out some incantation. A cool fog swooped over the rocks, and my feet felt the ice afresh. The orange lamplight glowed along the falling lace, and I reached down into this lace, quite gratified to find the edges of my sheets. So pleased, in fact, that I did not bother to wonder why my bedding had been delivered along in the arriving ripple of mist out here on the bald ridge. Regardless, I tugged the blankets upwards from the rocks and the moss and the mist and drew the covers all around me in a lazy flop as the fog and the rocks and the cold night air all vanished in the shadowy frame of my bedroom. And I fell into the nearest void of sleep.
Rock my boat, cold waves sway amidst the
I woke the following afternoon. The sun ran and poked and fished through the branches of the trees. Today, the plan was simple enough. To don my parade outfit for a bit of due diligence, to make sure it could withstand another outing. I turned on the mattress, bringing the sheets all with me. I could feel a hardship in my body now, and a constriction at my forearms. I rolled over a shoulder and loomed upward into standing. The sheets went like water to the floor, and a huge ache followed my body. Most shockingly, I discovered that some accident of movement had brought my black dress socks up and over my arms. And worse, the socks were not clean, as my nose had the misfortune to discover. I prized the socks from my arms and went to the closet, reaching into the dark recesses for the hard old vinyl bag where I stored my parade outfit. But its familiar bulk was missing. I tugged the bulb chain and then entered alongside my cool shirts and pants. But the clothing bag wasn't there. I glanced around the room nervously. The socks on the arms had been a dead giveaway. And there it was, more proof. In the corner of the room, unzipped and empty, my clothing bag. I sighed at the trouble I'd been making for myself with these outings. My somnambulism had returned with a vengeance. For 60 years or so, I've been untroubled by any nocturnal mischief. But I had been waking these last weeks more frequently than not to find strange dislocations in my cabin. Sandwiches half made on top of the radio, the doors all wide open, clothing strewn about. It was like living with a crackpot version of oneself. My Mr. Hyde was not wicked. He was just terribly untidy. I went to the kitchen, put some toast on and lit the flame for tea. There was very little I could do about the missing parade outfit. It's a lot like losing a wallet when you just absently placed it somewhere bizarre. Not thinking, just pushing it between a pair of books as though that's where it should go. A sleepwalker's logic is similar and especially woeful. The only thing I could do was to fumble over the remembered images of my dreams. For here, at least, there might be some clue as to my last night's activities. So I sipped my tea and ate the toast and struggled after the fleeting pictures I'd woken with of the abandoned house in the woods of the Macaw Meadows. There was a cold pressure at the windows and the light outside was already yellow and black. I went to the wood stove and stoked the embers with the poker and threw on some fresh wood, opened the flue until the fire roared. I went to my closet and drew on some comfortable clothes, sat on the bed and pulled on my fleece pants, which is when the miner's headlamp rolled against my hip. I didn't need any more proof that I'd been sleepwalking, but the fact of the miner's headlamp established that I'd left the cabin and gone for a solid wandering. For whatever reason, my sleeping self had some affinity for the old dim lantern. As evening was coming on, I looked for, and failed to find, the small flashlight that I carry with me when I go out as an awake person. I looked in the trash and then in the toilet. The tandem contrast of my affinity for the miner's lamp is my deep and abiding hatred for flashlights. At least as a sleepwalker, I cannot stand them and will destroy or dispose of them if I can. I drew on a winter coat and reluctantly lit the miner's lamp before cabling it up over my head. I made a quick cheese sandwich, took a stack of crackers, and I stowed these along with a flask of whiskey in the very large, flappy side pocket of my big coat. The dusky sky was a rotten, brownish purple. I cut toward the break in the trees and then turned along with the trickling river down toward the shoals. There was only a twinge of light prying the sky when I pushed into the thicket at the edge of the old estate. I stepped on the patches of grass in respect to their former status, as though to honour the home as a home, not just beams and nails sinking slowly into the wilderness. Once inside the ramshackle home, I probed around for my suit. I turned the lamp to full and searched the cupboards. There were leaves and sticks scattered everywhere on the wooden floor and bits of glass. Signs of animals coming and going, some empty beer cans. Near the front door, at the bottom of the rotten stairs, is a tipsy chair and old crate. I sat on the chair and set my supper on the box. I ate hungrily and sipped from the flask. Alcohol was contraindicated for the sleepwalker, so the doctor says. That among a dozen or so other pleasures. For some time as I ate, I'd been hearing the scratch and bother of a small animal, a raccoon or squirrel, perhaps even a deer, rustling in the leaves around the house. This persisted for the course of my meal, but then, distinctly, upsettingly, the sound shifted. Not at all the sound of a nocturnal creature crunching over the fall leaves. Oh no, it was the sound of a shovel digging. You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on 90.5 WSPS Concord Community Radio. For more information on the show and the songs, please visit my website at radioghost.com. I'm Sherwin Sleeves. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for more stories and music. Thank you, my friends.